Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org for today's special event, and we are very glad you could join us. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator. We are making a recording today, which will be available for download and replay from FEMA's Strategic Foresight Initiative website in a few days. Now, today's program is all about looking ahead to the future, hence the title of the new report from SFI, Crisis Response and Disaster Resilience 2030. Some of you may have been involved with the SFI for some time, but others may be completely new to the concepts. Either way, our purpose today is to provide some background and get your feedback. We will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to a discussion. Now, if you wish to capture a copy of today's presentation, you can click on the printer icon down at the bottom right, and that will present you with an opportunity to download a PDF copy. Now, if you have any difficulty with the live meeting, you may use the feedback drop-down menu up at the top right to indicate that you need help. And my associates, Ava Jean Moore and Lori Weber, will monitor that and try to assist you. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. David J. Kaufman has been the director of FEMA's Office of Policy and Program Analysis since his appointment during September 2009. In this position, he is responsible for providing leadership, analysis, coordination, and decision-making support to the FEMA administrator on a wide range of agency policies, plans, programs, and key initiatives. His previous service included establishing the Office of Preparedness Policy, Planning and Analysis in FEMA's National Preparedness Directorate, and Acting Director and Deputy Director of the Preparedness Programs Division in the DHS Office for Domestic Preparedness. Welcome, David. Thank you very much for joining us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking time out of all of your schedules to join us for the conversation this afternoon. As Amy pointed out, this is really a discussion about stepping back and taking a look at the ways in which the world around us is changing and how those changes may impact our mission space, broadly defined here in dealing with issues of crisis response and disaster management. I'll spend a few minutes at the start of the call kind of giving an overview of the initiative itself, how we've gone through our process, very briefly touch on our methodology and who's been involved, and spend most of my time talking about the findings and insights that we've developed up until this point. And then, obviously, we'll have time for question and discussion, which is the part that I'm most looking forward to. We launched the Strategic Foresight Initiative about 18 months ago, and we endeavored to do that collectively as a field of practice. The concern being that we didn't have enough space in the daily churn of our lives and our events to step back, take notice of slow change, or to try to ensure that we are well positioned to avoid strategic surprise in the future. And so this is really an exploration, and it's something that we're doing not singularly as FEMA, but rather underwriting and seeking to do together as a field of practice. By which we mean all the players involved in the business of dealing with emergencies and disasters in the United States. So that's many different disciplines, agencies at all levels of government, private industry, civil society, nonprofit organizations, faith-based organizations, et cetera. We felt it was important that we create a forum whereby we could come together and talk about and explore these issues, understand things that were changing in the world, and gain insight into how those may affect the operational requirements that we experience and the outcomes that we seek to deliver in fulfilling our missions. So that is the purpose of the initiative. It's a collective undertaking that FEMA is willing to and has stepped up to underwrite the conduct of and provide the forum for synthesizing all of our respective insight and putting that back out. We just released a week or two ago our first major report, Crisis Response and Disaster Resilience 2030, and I will walk through some of the major findings in that report in the discussion today, but I would refer you back to it for a deeper exploration of all the issues that we'll discuss. So I mentioned that this is something that we've undertaken together as a field of practice. This is just a snapshot of the kinds of folks that have been involved. To date, we have well over 800 participants in the community from all these different perspectives, and that's everything from academic experts to, you know, technical experts to on-the-ground operators to program managers that have been engaging in this process with us. We've had an extensive series of webinars and conference calls and outreach and research papers on individual pieces of the picture, as well as a robust scenario workshop that I'll talk about later last summer that all has helped us develop the insights that we have at this point in time. I mentioned methodology. I'll cover this very briefly because I think the more important part of the discussion is the substance, but this will at least give you an overview for how we arrived at the findings that we're going to talk about today. First step was stepping back and seeking to answer the simple question, who or what will affect the future of emergency management? We brought together representatives from 30 different organizations in August of 2010 and asked that question. And on the back end of that workshop, arrived with a list of 9 particular drivers that we thought were significant issues which had the ability to impact our mission space in meaningful ways. And I'll talk about those momentarily. Stemming from that, then, we began to dig into each of those drivers, research what the trends and the counter trends were, talk to experts, held different outreach sessions around them, seminars, et cetera, and really develop our understanding about what's happening in each of those areas. And we've published research papers on each of those drivers, which are on our website, and that's all informed the body of work we've held going forward. This process is not about prediction. This is about developing insight and understanding into the nature and nuance of the challenges that we may face in the future. And so it is important that we understand right up front that this is a tool to hedge against uncertainty. It is not an effort to predict precisely what we will be dealing with at any given point in time. One of the ways in which methodologically we hedge against that uncertainty is through the use of alternative scenarios. And so we put a considerable amount of effort and owe a debt of gratitude to the United States Coast Guard for allowing us to piggyback on their very well-developed work and their Longview project, Project Evergreen, to build alternative futures that would then explore the interactions among these different drivers and work through what kinds of issues are we likely to see in the event that things do go the direction that we think they may go or don't go that way, and arrive at findings that hold up across that whole spectrum of space. I'll go back through this as we go through the discussion and elaborate. You'll understand, I think, a little better what I mean. But that sort of brings us to where we are in the process, is an initial definition and understanding of strategic needs that we face as a field of practice as we look ahead over the coming 20 years. And that positions us for where we go from here, which is what this discussion is really a part of. How do we talk about those needs? How do we explore where opportunities exist to respond to those needs, either individually or collectively, and begin to align our strategies and our activity streams in a way that positions us well as a field to deal with those challenges going forward. So I mentioned the drivers and the fact that we identified 9 early on in this process. These are not the only 9 that matter. These are just the 9 that we identified with a degree of fidelity early on and that we spent time exploring. We've already begun identifying additional issues or varying takes on some of these issues that we haven't explored that we think would be worthwhile, and that's part of what we want to build into the process going forward. But the 9 that we did identify and have served as the foundation for framing the analysis and the work to date are the 9 you see on the screen in front of you. And I'll talk briefly about what each of these are and give you a snippet on some of the kinds of insights and implications that derive from each of these, and then we'll talk about how they interact with one another. And that's an important point that I'd like to emphasize as well. It's equally important to understand what's occurring in each of these areas as it is to understand how they affect one another and how they may interact. And the findings at the back end of the process are a product of both of those insights. So working in no particular order, but just trying to give you some insight, and there are a few points on the slide here, and I'll add to those as well. As we look at the state of infrastructure in the United States, there have been numerous studies that have pointed to the challenges that we face in this regard, the decay and degradation in our infrastructure, and the recapitalization costs facing us as a country, numbering in the trillions, and what does that mean then when we think about the nature of disasters, the services that rely on that infrastructure in order to deliver effective outcomes to people in need, as well as the fact that that infrastructure itself can contribute to the problem space that we're dealing with? So we see this as a significant consideration individually, and even more so when you start to think about it in conjunction with other things. Looking at the bottom of the slide, demographic shifts. The core population in the United States as it exists today is aging. It's also increasing in its diversity, and it's becoming more geographically concentrated, right? For the first time in human history, more than half of all humans live in urban areas, not in rural areas, and that trend is continuing. Within our country, we see people moving increasingly to coastal areas, to urban centers. Even as the overall population is aging, we see higher growth rates in minority populations and populations for whom English may not be their native language or their first language. And so this has all sorts of implications for how we communicate, how we coordinate, how we mobilize, and what kinds of needs we need to deliver in times of crisis. Pair that with the discussion about infrastructure above, right? People are moving to these areas where infrastructure is already under stress today. And if those trends intensify, that puts even further stress on those areas. One of the points that's not on the slide but is another of the driver that we've looked at is the changing climate. Not seeking to engage in a discussion about why it's changing, but the science is unequivocal. It is changing. And the nature of those changes have implications for our business. That means shifts in precipitation patterns, in storm patterns and intensity, in flooding risk, in wildfire risk, as well as impacts on population centers within the United States and abroad that may produce shifts in migrations and flows of people, either because you see changes in the nature of the economy or impacts to farming and agriculture and things of that nature. So looking at all of that, we see over time shifting nature or character in the nature of the hazards that we're facing in many contexts. We'll still face wildfire risk, but where we experience that wildfire risk may start to move. And we start to maybe be dealing with greater wildfire problems in new areas, creating different areas where you have sort of that wildland-urban interface and the training and coordination issues associated with that. Similarly, in the East Coast, you could be dealing with, in parts of, for example, northern Florida, both more intense precipitation and more drought. And so what does that do to the kinds of plans that we're developing and the kinds of capabilities that we're building, as well as how does that impact urban planning issues and things of that nature writ large? Moving on to talk about some of the other points. We looked closely at the state of government budgets within the United States, and this is governments at every level, but basically the fiscal constraint, the fiscal contraction that government is dealing with as a sector, and the challenges that poses for a field of practice that has made considerable investment in the past 10 to 15 years in building up capabilities within government, and what is the impact of reduction in resources pose for those capabilities. Fairly self-evident, it will be difficult to sustain much of what we've already created, and therefore a real challenge to be able to continue to deliver the quality of service we're able to do today into the future. And so that causes us to think about how we go about deploying the resources and the capabilities that we do have. Other areas that we spend time looking about, technology. Technology has revolutionized many things already as of today, right? We only have to think about the ways in which our daily work life is different today from 10 years ago to be able to project that forward and think about the kinds of things that may be different yet again in the future. But huge flows, huge implications on the flow of information, the availability of information, the way in which information is consumed and communicated, and corresponding implications with respect to trust and other things of that nature. So let me give you some examples. In one of the seminars that we held, it was before that the average American is exposed today to three times as much information every day as in the mid-1980s, and that the rate of increase is 30% a year. So for any of you who are like me, who are already overwhelmed by the number of inboxes you're trying to manage to and can't keep abreast of it as it is, that's a fairly intimidating statistic. And it's not going to get any better. What's interesting about that, though, is in that same conversation, which was really exploring the ways in which the role of the individual is changing in society, part of that has contributed to a real shift in the way people are using social networks. This is something that has real implications for all of us. So people are more and more using their social networks, and this is technology-enabled, but not solely a function of technology. But they're using their social networks as sentinels to flag information that we may care about, as validators, both of the importance of that information as well as its accuracy, its veracity, and as platforms for action. And so that has real implications for how we communicate, how we give out alert and warning, as well as understanding decision processes that are at work in disasters. Disaster management is an inherently social process, and decision-making in crisis is a social act. The average person checks in with 4 to 5 other people before deciding what to do under a mandatory evacuation order. And if you don't believe that, look around the next time you're in a building when the fire alarm goes off, because that same phenomenon is what you see displayed. People are checking in. They're milling about. Are you going? Is it a drill? Are you shutting down? Do you want to go get lunch? Should I bring my coat? All those sorts of questions are part of the processing cycle that we go through as humans in dealing with that information and then just deciding what to do or how to act. So step back and extrapolate that then to evacuation processes on a mass scale, or how we communicate about public health risks and how we ask people to take action in the face of those risks, whether it's to go to dispensation points to receive critical pharmaceuticals or to shelter in place in particular kinds of contexts, et cetera. Those shifts in the way people are consuming information and where they're turning to and in whom they're placing trust are profoundly meaningful. Another finding in this area is that the nature of trust is shifting. It's moving increasingly away from large institutions and to those social networks. And so it's becoming critically important to understand who the major influencers are in people's networks. Where is it that they receive that information from, and who do they turn to validate information that they do receive? Because that is critical for us in seeking out to ensure that we're communicating effectively, timely, and accurate information, but in a way that it gets into the hands of the people who need it in a manner that can inform their action. Moving to the last bullet that you see on the slide, and then I'll touch on a few other points before we move forward. We have seen revolutionary changes in the nature of the supply chain worldwide over the last 30 years. And it has morphed considerably. Just-in-time delivery models and manufacturing models have had huge impact on where excess capacity exists within the system for everything from utilities to the availability of food. So the average grocery store has roughly 3 days of food on hand in the United States. That's not the case when I grew up. There was much more food on hand than that at that point in time, but it is the case today. And moreover, the supply system is so near real time that you see mass movements occurring across a large scale in the United States to resupply all those stores. So the hundreds of grocery stores that occupy the I-95 corridor, which is roughly from Richmond to New York City and the East Coast, at the core, 50% of the food that goes to all those stores from all the different nameplates is supplied by 3 wholesale suppliers. And that's a really interesting phenomenon, because that tells us both about where strategic capacity exists in the supply chain that we can engage with for large-scale catastrophic planning and response, but it also represents incredible concentration risk. Disruption to the movements of those 3 core companies can have a ripple effect across a huge swath of this country in a very short order of time. And so those are real substantive changes that affect the mission requirements that we deal with and the solution space that we seek to occupy as a field of practice. And that's just the state that we're in today. projecting those trends forward exacerbates those issues and raises all sorts of questions about how digital demand signals are maintained when crises occur that disrupt the normal flow of those signals and ensure that supplies are being routed into the right areas and not away from those areas inadvertently. A couple other points that are worth mentioning in some of the other areas that we've looked at. First off, I won't go into it at length, but we see tremendous advances coming in the future in the areas of biotechnology and nanotechnology, remote sensing, et cetera, that have huge implications for advancing our ability to execute in our mission space, whether that's more quickly and more accurately determining the scale and impact of a disaster in order to turn on assistance programs, or whether that is on-the-ground delivery of support to people in need in particular contexts, or whether it's in the context of health advances and changing health risks. Additionally, you see real changes in the nature of empowerment at an individual level, and I'll give you a couple of anecdotes in that space to color in what we mean by this as we look forward. So I heard a great story on NPR about a year and a half ago. A woman had bought a Maytag appliance. She got home, had that appliance installed, and it didn't work right. So she called health support, tech support, and they sent somebody out, and they worked on it. And they left, and it still didn't work right. And this cycle repeated a couple more times before she got frustrated by the fact that her new appliance was still not working, and so she tweeted about it. She has 1 million followers on Twitter, or did at that point in time. And so all of a sudden, this was not a single customer to a large multinational. This is a major influencer who had a dissatisfactory experience with their product. Needless to say, she got her appliance fixed, but it drove home the point about how one person isn't always just one person anymore, and the scope and scale of influence and technology-enabled connection has shifted that boundary considerably. And that applies on the mobilization side as well. The snowball fight that we had happened here in the District of Columbia a couple of years ago, that was largely organized by one dedicated individual over a number of hours on social media, pulling that together. And if you want even more frightening examples of that, do a YouTube search for flash mobs. And watch as a public area will be flooded with thousands of people instantaneously, all coordinated through these kinds of technologies and by working through those social networks. Tremendous power, both for good and ill, embedded in those, but real implications for how we do business and for the kinds of challenges that we're seeking to deal with as a field of practice. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk lastly about shifts in the nature of the terrorism threat that we're dealing with. And I want to stress that we used only unclassified open source information in all of our analyses so that we can have these discussions openly and freely. But we are already seeing changes in the nature of the threat traffic, right? The actions that the United States and its allies have taken abroad have had a real effect on terrorist networks and have in turn precipitated a change in the nature of the threat that we're dealing with. Much more lone wolf actors, much more radicalization remotely, also a rising concern about domestic issues in that regard as well. It's very difficult to project what that might look like going forward into the future, but the path that that takes is clearly something that's going to have an impact on the kinds of issues that we're dealing with. So I spoke earlier about this issue of uncertainty and hedging against it, and I want to again underscore that what I just tried to do very, very briefly is touch on some of the trends and counter-trends in the areas of these different drivers. What is very important that we not do is zero in on any of those particular trends alone, presume that they will occur in exactly that way, and then plan against that. And so the approach that we took sought to explore tensions and what happens if something goes much more quickly than it looks like it might, and what happens if it goes the other way. So climate change, for example. What happens if we got it wrong? And all the projections about climate change simply don't pan out over the next 20 years, and we have incorrectly diagnosed this as a risk or as a factor in the risks that we face. And conversely, what happens if it's happening far more quickly than we think it is, and that it occurs much more severely and much more quickly than current projections indicate? Both of those alternatives matter. Because what we seek to do is explore those different tensions and then look for what holds up consistently. What are the issues and concerns that we have in both of those cases with respect to climate? Because those are robust and those are meaningful to us and things that we should be paying attention to now. There are some that may be situationally specific and are notable and important to consider in that manner, but we're principally concerned with, at this point, looking for the issues, the problems, the needs that span that spectrum fairly consistently. And so this past summer, we designed a week-long scenario workshop where we built five alternative futures, again, building on the work that the U.S. Coast Guard program has done in this regard. And those alternative futures were designed to explore those different tensions. So some involved worlds where climate change happened much more quickly than planned. Some involved worlds where it didn't pan out the way people think it will at all. Similarly, with the state of governmental budgets. In some, the economy is back and it's roaring, and we're flush, so to speak. In others, the fiscal contraction that we've seen to date is just the tip of the iceberg, and it's far, far worse. And so we work through those different futures and look for what are the strategic needs, what are the nature of the challenges that emergency management as a field of practice, again, broadly defined, is struggling with in each of those five worlds. And then we took those and carried them into the other four worlds to see which ones held up across the board. And so what I'm about to show you are a grouping of, as we've characterized them, strategic needs that seem to hold true across the board. And as such, we feel are robust in the face of uncertainty are important things to begin to focus our attention on now, because more likely than not, these are going to be issues that affect us no matter what the future holds. So here they are. We grouped them into three basic themes, and there's considerably more amplification on these issues in the report itself, which, again, I would encourage you to download from our website and take a look at. We tried to make it very accessible and a quick read, but still convey meaningful information. So we grouped them into three themes around essential capabilities, around the nature of the models and tools that we need to employ, and then lastly, around the relationships and the partnerships that we need to have and the dynamic nature therein. So I won't talk at length about all of these. Again, the point of this discussion is to whet your appetite and give you a flavor for the nature of the challenges, and then leave time for us to talk about it in the discussion period. But I do want to touch on a few of these. So in the essential capabilities, you see in here this idea of omnidirectional communication, knowledge sharing. That's really critical because that means that's communicating among many different partners and always in a two-directional way. And this was particularly powerful and showed up in a strong way with respect to how we in government communicate with those outside of government and hear from those outside of government. What is the exchange that's occurring in both directions, in the way, in the information that we're sharing, in the way we're engaging around understanding needs, understanding challenges, planning against those needs and challenges, and delivering outcomes. We talked a lot about volunteer capabilities and the pools of volunteers that we currently leverage in our field of practice, and yet what a small slice of overall volunteering capability and volunteer action that represents from across the picture writ large, and the need to expand into that space and be more aggressive in empowering volunteer services to assist in delivery of meaningful outcomes in their communities, enable that, and work cooperatively with that in a meaningful fashion. In the innovative models and tools section, there's some really meaningful discussion around risk management tools and processes. And this is something that I want to spend a minute talking about. For the most part, the way we do hazard identification and risk assessment is done looking in a rearview mirror. It's historical probabilities of experienced disasters over time run through Monte Carlo simulation and projected forward. For many of those hazards, the past is not indicative of the future based on the changes we've already seen occur in the climate today, let alone the changes that may occur going forward. So we are already underestimating risk in critical areas. That has huge implications because those analyses and correspondingly the cost-benefit decisions and calculations that go into informing our mitigation decisions and our rebuilding decisions. We're talking about billions of dollars of investment every year that we spend mitigating against future risk and rebuilding communities that have suffered disasters in the country, all of which is potentially undervaluing true risk exposure in the future because we're not adequately considering the ways in which the climate is changing and the impact that that has on storm risk, on flood risk, et cetera, et cetera. So what's being spoken to here is the need for much more dynamic processes that are really projecting forward and allowing for more uncertainty and more range projection in how we do our assessments and in how we manage against the risk that we identify. It's a very difficult analytic challenge, but it's one that we can take on and can make progress against. Similarly, the point above there on alternative surge models, this is something that really stood out at me, is as we looked at the landscape going forward, increasing requirements to surge resources to large crises. Well, every time we do that, we take away from other mission areas in other places. And the cumulative effect of that poses risk of mission degradation in other areas. It also is when looked at in conjunction with constrained resources and fiscal constraints, we are already challenged to deliver the scale of effective services and outcomes that we need to when the crisis is really bad today. As we see the problem space worsening going forward and we see the resource base being put under increasing pressure, that challenge becomes even more severe. And it's going to force us to think about how we surge, who we use to surge, where that surge comes from, how it's coordinated and arranged, and get a little bit more proactive, proactive maybe isn't the best word, but creative in thinking about the resources that we can bring to the table to deal with large-scale crises in the future. In the area of dynamic relationships and partnerships, here as well, some real interesting discussion around changes that, by and large, were assessed to be occurring across all of the alternative futures. A greater role being played by the private sector, a greater role being played by civic organizations, faith-based organizations, non-governmental organizations, more empowerment and more mobilization on the part of the public seeking to play a larger role themselves in these issue areas. The question really becomes one of how does sort of officialdom and established practice and the practitioner community deal with those manifestations? And do those things emerge out of close cooperation and collaboration, or do they emerge in opposition to one another? And that's a meaningful challenge that I think will face all of us going forward. But across the board, we see more play in those areas from more people that challenges the way the system's currently designed to not just allow for that, but enable that and encourage that. And so you see that play up in the context of individuals and communities, business, as well as internationally. How we play in disaster management issues abroad, but also how international resources play in dealing with crises within the United States going forward. I've talked through the points on this slide already, so I will move on. I have a tendency to do that at times. My apologies. I want to spend a minute and just sort of bring this all up to a so what level of macro discussion, and then wind up a little bit with the path forward and ensure that we have plenty of time for questions and discussion. So, bottom line, we're facing a world with increasing complexity, decreasing predictability, and I would assert increasing risk. Increasing risk systemically, but also changes in the nature of the risk that we're dealing with. And across the board, this issue of resource constraints is not going away. This is not just a function of money, of resources in that sense. It's also a function of more challenging problem space. So even in the cases where the economy is roaring and governments are flush, the resource base is still insufficient to deal with the increasing severity of the challenges we're dealing with. And so that issue of constrained capability, constrained resources is there for us across the board, and challenges then how we deal with that, and how we rethink some of our approaches. This point that I underscored a moment ago about individuals, families, neighborhoods, communities, the private sector playing an increasingly active role. What remains to be determined is the nature of that role, the way that role is enabled and supported by those in the practitioner community, by governments, et cetera, and how that comes into being. And then lastly, come back to this point about trust. Trust is absolutely critical and essential to everything that we do. We're communicating crisis information. If trust is not there, that information is viewed as suspect. Terrorism is an attack on social trust. That's what's seeking to be eroded through terrorist attack, is the trust and confidence in the compact between the government and its citizenry. The effectiveness with which we can deliver outcomes to people in need requires trusted relationships and insight and understanding to the true nature of those needs and an ability to connect with the players that can meet those needs. So all of this is critical and something that we have to really actively strengthen, because it's under stress right now, and the way we see things emerging over the coming decades will further strain some of those issues. And so that's a really critical area for all of us. As we think about some of this, right, I think personally that there's tremendous applicability of an explosion of work in the behavioral sciences to us in our business. Better understanding on what drives people's behaviors, on the dynamics that drive their choices and their decision-making, both individually and collectively. All sorts of opportunity there to look at behavioral economics and similar and related fields and gain insight that can help us understand new strategies to employ within our own. Similarly or equally, critical importance on taking on this issue of working through and connecting with the powerful influencers in people's social networks and understanding who they are, where they sit, how to engage productively so that the information that needs to be provided is provided through the ways in which people are predisposed to receive it and through the places that they're going to turn to naturally in crisis. Right? We're all familiar with sports or military analogies. We train like we want to fight, or practice the way we want to play in the game. What we're doing is building mental and physical pathways that take the brain out of the equation and move it more to instinct so that we react very, very quickly. Well, people do that as a matter of course, right? We react to issues the way we're used to dealing with them. And so the more we practice it, the more quickly we can do that reaction, hence the importance of evacuation drills and fire alarms. But I think that same phenomenon plays out at a community level. Communities turn to the places when they're under crisis that they turn to deal with everyday issues. That's where they go for help. That's where they go for information, for insight, for support. And so it puts a tremendous, opens up a tremendous opportunity space to better understand where those places are and how they can be connected with and supported through the work that we do in the area of emergency management in a manner that can deliver better outcomes when crisis does occur. So that sort of brings us to where we are in our process. We have an initial round of findings. We do not view this as a one-off project. This isn't to publish a report and we're done. Rather, I think this is a sustained discussion thread that we need to maintain as a community of practice going forward, and we're willing to underwrite that. And so we see the path forward being a mix of several things. Adding new areas that we need to research and dig into and explore. What are the issues that we didn't look at that we should have? What really resonates but we would like to have explored from a different angle or in more depth? We have opportunities to do that. Talk about these implications. Find out which of them have traction in members of our community's daily lives. What are the things that we can do to align the direction that we're already taking and accelerate it? One of the real sort of reactions I had to looking at the totality of the body of work is that there really is very little that we found in the way of strategic needs that I haven't heard anyone talk about before. And that's a good thing. That means we are already beginning to pull on these different threads. The downside or the flip side to that, the other shoe in the analogy, is that I don't think we're moving quickly enough or deeply enough in those areas to deal with the nature of the challenges that we're seeing based on this body of work. And so the good news is that we're already moving in the right direction in many of these areas. The challenge is to figure out how to accelerate that movement, how to go more quickly and more broadly forward. So my last sort of closing comment in the way of insights before I open it up to discussion, and I've got a few questions that I'll put up to prompt that, is this. As I step back and reflect on what the preponderance of effort has been in our field of practice over the past 10 to 12 years, it really has been about breaking down silos within and across government. We have made unbelievable progress in fostering multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional, multi-level of government mechanisms for coordinating action, for planning, for resource allocation, for building capability, for communicating, et cetera. It's really quite phenomenal. And if you step back and look around the room and the ways in which people are seated and arranged in national conferences, excuse me, to me at least, it looks nothing like it did 12 years ago. 12 years ago, people sat in discipline clusters and geographic clusters, and now it's a smattering. It's multi-jurisdictional and it's multidisciplinary all at the same table, and that's just naturally the way of interaction. And I think that's indicative of the kind of progress and change that we've made in a very positive way. And that aligns with the things that we've called out as national priorities over that time, fostering incident command, fostering regional approaches to planning and capability building, et cetera. But as I look at this body of work and then project forward what the next 10 years may need to be about, it's that same process, but now moving beyond government and looking at how we break down silos and break down stovepipes in that same way, but across sectors, and create that same sort of dynamic exchange and fluidity across the public sector, private sector, and the civic sector in a way that can allow for much more collective capacity to be brought to bear to deal with the challenges that we're all facing. These are inherently societal challenges, and more we're needing to drive to societal solutions to address them. So I'll leave my remarks at that. I know we've got a little bit of time left for discussion. These are just some prompts that I would put up to maybe get us started. But, Amy, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you very much, David. You didn't actually use the term whole community, but it sounds like that's what you're talking about on this ending remarks here. I'm going to go ahead and put up the instructions for our discussion, and but then I will come back to these points that you have raised. Okay, in order to ask a question or to put in your thought, you just click on Q&A from the top menu, then a little box will open up, and you will type in the top half of that, and then you click on Ask or just hit Enter. Now, there is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that feature. When you click on Ask, your question or comment is going to go to an administration panel that I will moderate, and then I will announce who the question or comment is from, and read aloud over the bridge, and if David has a response, he will respond over the bridge. And then after I've read it, I will type in OK, and the text will appear in the bottom half of that Q&A panel. Now, because of the way live meeting works, you will only be able to submit one question or comment at a time. Now, please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise, since I need to read them. And then I will go ahead and change back to where we were for these questions that David has posed. So we are ready to begin now, and you may enter your comments or questions at any time. And we have a few for you already. Starting with Bob Fletcher, who says, I congratulate Dave and FEMA for its engagement in strategic planning of this type. Futurists have labored for many years with societal challenges of this type, as has DARPA and other government think tanks. FEMA's efforts to bring critical analysis and strategic thinking into mainstream risk management and homeland security emergency management arena is commendable. Yesterday's strategic thinking is today's short-term planning and tomorrow's reactive response. I would be interested in hearing Dave's view on how this initiative might impact upon the body of DHS FEMA policy and regulatory doctrine that has been crafted to centrally direct, guide contingency planning at state and local levels as well as into the private sector. Will top-down direction be replaced by real-time collaborative planning in support of unfolding local initiatives? That one was a bit long, but David, to you.
I think I got the gist of it. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate you taking the time to engage. Absolutely, that is the direction we think we need to go. Sort of concurrent with this whole process, as Amy indicated, we have been developing this conversation around whole community, and these two things have reinforced one another. But we are right now looking at our own posture, trying to put in a force posture that is leaning forward, that's anticipatory and integrative at all levels, and that is enabling. And so maybe I'll give you a tactical example that's sort of from the response context, but then try to bring that back to what I think was the crux of your question overall. And that has to do with how we're coordinating our own logistics movements with that of major private sector players. So during Irene, during the ice storms last winter, we were coordinating the movements of our logistics supplies, trying to stay ahead of those storms with that of Walmart and Target and other large stores. The point being so that we're not in competition with one another, but are rather in a position to be complementary. If a store is open, we don't need to be delivering our supplies in that same place. We need to be going where the places are that commodities are not available. And so maintaining that insight and getting that so that is much more integrative on the fly is really important and absolutely the direction that we want to go. We're right now going back through and really carefully taking a look at the policy framework that we operate under as an agency and trying to think about the nature of the challenges that we've just discussed, as well as the strategic direction and the posture and the philosophy that we want to project as an agency, and looking at the places that we need to begin to make changes in the policies we have in place, the ways in which we do business ourselves as an agency. I think that's critically important. I fear I've lost a piece at the end of that question. My apologies. I'm happy to follow up with you at another point, but I couldn't retain all of that in my mind.
At the bottom end of the question was, will top-down direction be replaced by real-time collaborative planning in support of unfolding local initiatives?
Yes, I think that's – thank you for bringing that up. I think that's exactly the direction that we need to go. I think it's hard to figure out exactly what that means in practice. And that's what we're seeking to. But those principles, those ideas are firmly embedded in Presidential Directive 8 on national preparedness, in the national preparedness goal, the national preparedness system that were just released. And as many of you, I think, are aware, the government's engaged now in developing national frameworks for prevention, protection, mitigation, redoing the national response framework, and we just published the national disaster recovery framework. And those themes of sort of power to the edge of battle, and enabling local initiative and supporting that action are absolutely themes that are seeking to be pushed throughout that. I think you see that pretty clearly in the President's statement of direction.
Right. We do have a number of questions waiting. We have one from Joseph Martin, and he says, I know that much of the focus still appears to be on response and preparedness, but to what extent should mitigation and integrating risk management into our communities and city management principles, a la integrated disaster risk management, take importance as we look towards 2030?
So I am really glad that you asked that question because I do not think that this is about response. And if I did not give enough examples from other areas to make that clear, my apologies. There are huge issues. One of the biggest issues that stems from this conversation about infrastructure and some of the shifts in climate is a real need to be engaging as emergency managers and as a community of practice in community planning discussions and infrastructure planning discussions and development discussions in a forceful way so that we can communicate what the full risk exposure is from some of these things that we're contemplating and engage in the give and take, right? These are always balancing acts in those decisions, and it's important to consider local economic benefit and jobs and tax revenue, et cetera, but it's also important to understand what's the risk exposure over time of different planning decisions. And for me, that's one of the areas where the implications of what we've been looking at are very stark, are very significant, and where we have a lot of room to go to develop tools that help us present that picture, communicate that information, to, and convey that full understanding across the board. So I think that's a great issue.
Next from Pat Schaefer, who says, you spoke about hazard identification and risk assessments needing to change. Currently, there is not a systemic formula for risk assessments to be conducted. Do you foresee an alignment of methodology that all divisions in FEMA, state, local jurisdictions can use to be speaking the same language of risk?
I like that question. I am not a purist in this sense, personally. I think that it's very easy to get trapped in an argument about what the golden methodology is, and frankly, I don't think there is one. I think there are many valuable methodologies for many particular problems, but what we don't do as well as I think we should or could do is dialogue meaningfully about the policy judgments and the prioritization of how we're interpreting the findings. So what I mean by that, you could use the same methodology and assess the same information with different people sitting in different positions in different agencies at different levels of government or in and out of government. We'll still see the findings and interpret them in different ways because their interests are different. And so the things that are important at a federal level may be different and we all understand are different than the things that are important at a local level. And similarly, when you're looking, you know, from the standpoint of a private company and from the standpoint of a nonprofit that has a particular mission focus. Where there's tremendous space to tackle this is in opening that exchange. Because the more we can build shared context in that way, the more we can facilitate shared understanding. And what we're really doing is building our ability to effectively coordinate and deliberate in times of crisis. Eleanor Ohlstrom has a nice, I don't know what you call it, progression that a colleague has shared with me sometime in the past. Participation begets collaboration. Collaboration begets deliberation. Or put differently, if you want to be able to make decisions together, you first have to be able to work together. And if you want to be able to work together, you first have to interact and participate together in something. You build that shared context and understanding through that progression in a way that allows you to get to the other side. And so when it matters most is when that shared perspective is going to be most important.
I have a question from William Fry. I believe he's referring to the scenarios. He says, what changes in our political environment did you consider? For example, will our trend of federalization continue?
That's a great question. We did not. That was not one of the issues that we looked at in this analysis. I'll say that's the first time that's come up, and I'm intrigued by it. I think that merits discussion on whether that's something that we should be considering, and if so, where we would be looking for trends or for data that could inform that that exploration. It's a great point.
I have a question from Claire Rubin, and she says, I did not see mention of education, both of existing FEMA staffers and of future practitioners who are in higher education programs in emergency management throughout the U.S. And I think she's going towards, you know, preparing the next generation.
I think that's a great point, Claire. So I would characterize as education is part of the solution space. And what we try to be careful about is scoping this to the problem space. But the one flows right into the other. If you look through the discussion of strategic needs in the report, you actually will see discussion around education and the importance of education in several different contexts. But it isn't brought out as explicitly as it maybe should be. And I think that's a fair observation. I think we believe, at least here in FEMA, we believe that that's a tremendously powerful place to go, and something that we need to invest considerably in is how do we take input into the education process in a way where we can build better understanding both population-wise and then also within the professional community. And so we've got tremendous investments underway in education programs and constructing a national academy for emergency management in sort of the professional space. And then we've been doing a lot of interesting things over the last few years at a grassroots level with supporting education programs in schools, all of which I think is critically important and can be could be pursued much more aggressively.
A question from Chris Sager. He says, you spoke of public trust in government. How should professional responders demonstrate trust in volunteers?
I love that question. I won't pretend to have a perfect answer or anything more than maybe part of the answer. But I think it's about recognition and respect and reciprocity. I think those kinds of words are really at the middle of at the heart of it. And, you know, opening up the table, granting a seat at the table that's meaningful, engaging on level playing field as equal partners, and supporting and seeking to understand what it is we can do to support and allow that to unfold. Support it where needed, offer the assistance that's asked for, but let it be on the terms of the voluntary organizations and in a way that empowers them to act and doesn't seek to just control or manage the way the role that they're playing entirely. I think that, for me, is really at the crux of it. Amy, you with me?
I'm sorry, I was speaking to the mute. Apologize. I said we do have time for a couple more questions. So I have one from Ava Jean. And she says, the SFI report mentions, quote, a large and growing body of global best practices that we can learn from and utilize. I believe strongly in this. However, in the EIP's 14-year history, we find little or no interest in subjects related to lessons learned from outside our borders. How do you suggest we overcome this?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question. I'm going to interpret it as we find little or no interest within the United States in learning lessons from experience abroad. I may not have the right interpretation of that question.
Yeah, that's what she's saying.
Correct me. I think the reality is just look around the world. Look at just the experiences of the past 2 years, right? We have Haiti. We have Japan. We have Chile. We have lots of major catastrophes and a whole slew of disasters, the flooding in Pakistan, and all of these offer opportunities to understand how different models and different practices have played out. I'll tell you, for our own part, within FEMA, we're very interested in learning from that. We've launched a comparative study program. I currently chair what's now grown to a 9-country informal working group looking at community experiences in the context of local community resilience. And trying to understand things that can be done to advance community resilience in a productive fashion based in no small part on the experiences of communities in other countries around the world. We've spent considerable amount of time and attention looking at what happened in Japan and trying to apply those lessons back into our own context. But I don't think we do nearly enough. I think the reality is, you know, we live in a broader environment. And this was a theme that was pretty powerful at the scenario planning workshop last summer. A number of people kind of made that observation. There's a lot going on in this space outside our borders, and we have a lot to benefit from in terms of learning how those processes are working and what can be brought in into our own practice from that. So I think there is footholds in moving in that direction, and there's interest there, but I think there's tremendous opportunity.
And let me piggyback on that. I think the report also highlights the need for the collaboration, closer collaboration, perhaps with Canada and Mexico. Have you taken the SFI and engaged Canadian and Mexican partners yet?
Not specifically around SFI, although I have had some discussions with Canada. at an international conference in New Orleans the other week, and there was an expression of interest in opening that dialogue. I will tell you that we have engaged with Canada around issues of resilience, and we've engaged with both countries around cross-border mutual aid and things of that nature. But SFI on its own hasn't been the subject of a direct conversation at this point.
All right. We are running out of time. I'm going to put up your last contact slide here. For those, we had a couple questions, comments remaining, but if you will want to follow up, you see this mailing address, and they have a mailing list there. And then, again, here is the link to the SFI website, and, of course, that was linked from our background page for today's session. David, on behalf of AD and myself, all our participants today, thank you very much for taking the time to share this information with us, and thanks to your staff for their assistance in preparing today's program.
Thank you. Thank you both. I've really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed the discussion. Anybody who did have questions that we didn't get a chance to get to here, if you want to submit those into the email address, we will absolutely respond to them and engage with you in that capacity. And I would encourage anyone who's interested to contact us. This is an open process where we all own it, and we're here to be meaningful in supporting that. So we welcome your participation. We welcome your insights, your ideas, and your engagement going forward. Thank you all for taking the time.
Thank you very much. And just a couple of announcements on behalf of emforum.org. For our first-timers today, please note that we do have regular webinar programs on a wide range of emergency management topics twice a month, normally on the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month at noon Eastern, during the lunchtime on the East Coast anyway. And if you would like to receive our future announcements, you can subscribe from our homepage at www.emforum.org. And then also note you can earn CEUs for participating through a partnership with Jacksonville State University, and details are linked from our homepage. Thanks to everyone for participating today. Great comments, great questions, and we hope you have a great afternoon and a very pleasant evening. Thank you all. We are adjourned.